Roper Technologies from manufacturing to software. This case is part of the capital cycle concept sequence in the Common Cog case library. Roper Technologies Incorporated ranks as the seventh largest software company in the United States of America as of 2022. It was incorporated more than a century ago, but for a majority of this time, it was not a technology company. Roper was a classic industrial conglomerate, capital hungry and diversified across unrelated verticals. Fast forward to today, the company describes itself as developing vertical software products for niche markets. This is the story of how a sprawling manufacturing giant transformed into a software powerhouse. Roper's roots date back to a corporation that made gas stoves and gear pumps in the late 1800s. The two divisions operated under the same corporate structure until being separated in the 1950s. Over the next three decades, the kitchen appliance company flourished, its annual sales growing to roughly 25 times that of the industrial segment. However, it is Roper Industries and the gear pump business that formed the groundwork of the software company we know today. In June of 1982, Derek Key, a seasoned management consultant, joined Roper Industries as vice president. Key climbed the corporate ladder to become CEO of the company in December of 1991. The company, which had gone private as a result of a leveraged buyout, returned to the public market in 1992. With Key at the helm, Roper's business portfolio underwent its first major transformation. Key acquired a series of companies over the next 9 years. Initially, the targets were similar to Roper's existing business, but over time, more capital was allocated to buy market leaders in niche oligopolies. This included acquisitions of testing, measurement, and digital imaging companies. Roper shifted away from selling commoditized industrial products at scale and toward domains which rewarded product performance and customer relationships. Key also designed a new model of management, where P&L ownership of each product line was assigned to a single manager. These strategies worked. When Key stepped down in 2001, the company's revenue had increased from around $70 million to $587 million. Even though Roper's profile had changed a lot, it still bore the scars of its industrial heritage. 20% of the company's revenue was tied up in working capital, and its performance was at the mercy of cyclical market dynamics. To put it more crudely, the company nearly died every time oil prices dived. A sharper pivot was needed. It was against this context that Brian Jellison, Executive Vice President of Ingersoll Rand, was offered the opportunity to be CEO of Roper. As an executive, Jellison was smart, opinionated, and unconventional. His term at Ingersoll Rand had left him just fed up with how little time was spent on actually focusing on creating shareholder value. His frustration had gotten to the point that at age 55, Jellison jumped at the chance to head Roper. This move, to be clear, was not conventional. Roper was seen as a small and largely irrelevant manufacturer. Jellison, on the other hand, had a stellar resume. He had gone through GE's management training program as a young man before quickly rising up the ranks in Ingersoll Rand, with some saying he was in line to be CEO. A GE-trained top-tier exec like Jellison would not typically take such career risks so late in his career. And yet, took it he did. Jellison is known as the architect of Roper, as we know it today, because he accelerated the company's pivot from industry to software, a move that proved to be highly lucrative. Between 2001 and 2023, Roper compounded its per-share equity value at around 16%, nearly double of the S&P 500's 8.5%. The company has also been a 26-bagger since 2001, At the start of his tenure, Jellison put in place a single financial measure that Roper could use to evaluate all investment opportunities. This unit, Cash Return on Investment, or CRI, is calculated as follows. CRI equals net income plus depreciation and amortization minus maintenance capex, divided by net working capital plus net PP&E plus accumulated depreciation. Increasing CRI, according to Jellison, would not only lead to a higher multiple on current cash flow, but also accelerate the rate at which free cash flow compounded in the future. He also believed that gross investment in property, plant and equipment was a clear and certain call on future cash flow that was rarely considered by teams when they made investment decisions. Cash flow was Jellison's North Star. One could go so far as to say it was his only star. Even on investor calls, Jellison spared little time to discuss EPS, focusing instead on how business performance translates to CRI and cash flow. Joseph Shaposhnik of investment fund TCW said of these calls,
"One of the funny things that he would say after he provided the cash flow guidance, he would say, 'For those of you that care about EPS,' and then he would share the EPS guidance. That's the way he felt about EPS. 'For those of you that care about EPS, here's our EPS guidance.'"
But this was hugely counterintuitive at the time. GE was so dominant, and the Church of Jack Welch so ingrained in industrial America, that the vast majority of Jellison's competitors ignored cash flow as a desirable trait in target acquisitions. Instead, they focused on size. In Lessons from the Titans, senior equity analyst Scott Davis explains,
"In those days, large capital equipment was all the rage in industrials. Most were trying to model themselves on GE with big-ticket items like compressors, turbines and engines. The belief was that the spare parts and service made up for a lower margin install price and high capital costs. Business schools and management programs focused on concepts like Porter's Five Forces Analysis. Big pieces of capital equipment seem to offer amazing barriers to entry and power over suppliers, and the power in the sales channel grew with each install, even if it meant sacrificing cash terms in order to close an order. At Ingersoll Rand, Jellison saw firsthand the obsession that leaders had with this business model. GE's success was so well established at that point that few questioned any of the basic assumptions. Razor blade was the business model everyone wanted to copy, no matter the cost. By contrast, Jellison saw far higher margin and cash flow characteristics in basic businesses, notably the instrumentation and controls that often sat on top of these pieces of capital equipment. Flying under the radar often meant margins twice what the main suppliers earned, and the overall investment needs were limited and easier to cut back on in recession periods. The factories were smaller, closer to the customer overall, and focused on final assembly. Jellison also saw the big players increasingly interested in larger, splashy M&A deals, smaller niche assets, sub $500 million and even sub $100 million, garnered more attractive prices. In addition, he saw that smaller company managers were usually more intimate with their businesses overall, and respected within their organizations, but had not been incentivized appropriately. Critical to Jellison's contrarian view was the mathematical reality that stock market PE ratios directly correlate to returns on the underlying asset base of the entity, meaning that PE ratios usually rise as the returns on the underlying assets grow. The very highest PE multiples are at companies whose business models have few physical assets to maintain and high margins on that low asset base. Companies with low asset intensity and high margins typically generate lots of cash. And companies with these characteristics that also grow are particularly attractive, as each incremental dollar of growth drives returns even higher.
This final observation was what led to Roper's CRI metric. Jellison also upended the way Roper incentivized employees. He replaced the usual bonus negotiations with a scheme that paid bonuses based on one parameter, improvement of the individual business unit's operating earnings, or EBITDA. Encouraged to increase CRI, senior executives began to gravitate towards capital light, technology-led businesses with high margins. In the same interview, Shaposhnik said on CRI and Jellison's other changes,
"These changes resulted in remarkable simplicity and clarity. Roper had one measure for the quality of the business, cash return on investment, one P&L for each business, and a clear line of sight to the performance of each company that they owned. One metric for managers, operating income growth on a year-over-year basis. One team responsible for M&A, top management led by the CEO at the head office in Sarasota, Florida, and one goal, free cash flow compounding at a high rate."
Jellison was knocking it out of the park, and he knew it. Shaposhnik recounted Jellison's reaction when an investor complimented Jellison by saying that he had managed to generate a performance nearly as good as Berkshire Hathaway and Warren Buffett.
Brian got angry. Brian got mad. He glared at that shareholder and he grabbed a black marker and jumped up, got on the whiteboard and proceeded to explain how the investor was completely wrong and how his record and Roper's record was far better than Berkshire Hathaway's record, far better than Warren Buffett's record, and proceeded to list all of the capital investments and acquisitions that had been done by Roper since Brian had become CEO and all of the decisions that Warren Buffett had made over that period of time to explain in a quantitative way why that investor was wrong and why Brian and Roper had a better record than Warren Buffett.
The other way, in fact the primary way, Jellison reoriented Roper was through acquisitions. The bulk of Roper's growth was through M&A. Just 2 years after being named CEO, Jellison bought a company for around $475 million, a sum that accounted for a third of Roper's market capitalization. The target, Neptune, owned 35% of a niche segment, the US residential market for water meters. It boasted EBITDA adjusted margins of 29% and high recurring revenue numbers with around two-thirds of sales for replacing existing meters. Even better, since the company made meters built to order, there was little cash tied up in inventory. Neptune was also automating meter reading with a then-unique technology, which meant secular growth due to demand from utilities who were slowly switching over to more automation. Jellison loved the asset because he saw it as an upgrade over Roper's existing businesses. It was relatively non-cyclical, and whilst it still owned factories, these factories were mostly an assembly-type production line with limited heavy equipment or tooling. But he had a hard time getting board approval for the sizable transaction. In Lessons from the Titans, Davis writes,
"Convincing the board to be aggressive was no easy task. Roper's legacy board was conservative, and Jellison had not yet been named chairman. His plan was compelling and simple, but required a level of change the board struggled with. Many board members flat out rejected the notion that anything other than smaller bolt-on acquisitions were needed. Several other board members wanted Roper to stick to its core and roll up other pump assets. Beyond the unconventional M&A strategy that Jellison was pitching, he wanted to drive change within the organization itself. He wanted to upgrade management more broadly, run a more decentralized playbook, and change compensation schemes, all of which made the conservative board uncomfortable."
In the end, though, Jellison got his way. Roper paid 8x EBITDA for Neptune. Coming out of a deep recession, the timing was perfect. Other competitors were hindered by high debt levels. Neptune's growth itself had stalled due to the economic slump, which made it unattractive. Jellison faced effectively no competition for the deal, but Neptune's flat growth was a risk. Jellison had fought tooth and nail to get board approval for the transaction. If Neptune didn't work out, or if it took too long to work out, Jellison would have lost the board's trust. Davis writes that had that first deal not been a success from day one, there likely would not have been a second. For Jellison, Neptune was the most important bet of his career. Luckily, Neptune's growth returned quickly after the recession. The business went on to grow organically at high single-digit rates for the next two decades. A year later, in 2003, Roper made another big acquisition. The company paid $600 million for TransCore, a transportation products and services company. This deal, in many ways, was Roper's gateway to software. TransCore housed a data analytics business called Dial-A-Truck. At the time of the acquisition, Dial-A-Truck, although the largest freight matching network in the United States, was nothing more than an afterthought. However, the division, which harbored the cash flow benefits of a software business, rapidly grew in importance. Management would even later claim, falsely, that Dial-A-Truck was a hidden gem and the whole reason they bought TransCore. Shaposhnik said of the impact of the Neptune and TransCore acquisitions,
"The two transactions that the company engaged in collectively represented $1.1 billion of invested capital, similar to the company's market cap when Jellison took over the company in 2001 and dramatically reduced its dependence on the classic cyclical industrial markets and set it on a path of building a highly recurring, economically resilient and free cash flow compounding machine."
More importantly, though, Neptune and TransCore was early validation for Jellison that he was onto something, and that the then prevailing stance towards acquisitions in corporate America was bananas. In Lessons from the Titans, Davis writes,
"At Ingersoll Rand, Jellison ran businesses that required as much as 20% working capital as a percentage of sales in order to operate. Those industrial assets required capital investment on top of the daily cash needs, new factories, replacement of old equipment, and so on, often adding another 2-4% of sales, not including what needed to be spent on R&D, 3% of sales or more, to keep the product cycles moving. That doesn't even account for hidden expenses that often weigh on traditional manufacturers, including legacy environmental and pension liabilities. Jellison was astounded that those risks were never even considered by most companies when they bought assets. M&A deals were largely valued the same. The valuation for an asset-heavy company with potential tail liabilities was not much less than the valuation for a software company. In fact, if the asset-heavy company had razor-razor blade characteristics, its valuation was often higher. Jellison saw broad incompetence by M&A market participants. Investment bankers focused pitches on consolidating end markets and making easy-to-do deals where the value was in the synergies, like closing factories and corporate headquarters. Boards wanted easy-to-explain combinations, regardless of whether the underlying business itself was good or bad. He found it insane that a company like GE would sell a high-margin, high-cash asset like NBC Universal for 10 times EBITDA, analogous to cash flow, only to turn around and buy capital-intensive and cyclical assets in oil and gas for prices exceeding 12 times EBITDA. Capital-intensive semiconductor companies traded for the same valuation as low-capital-intensity software assets. Healthcare equipment was valued as highly as healthcare IT software. It made no sense to him."
Indeed, Jellison's approach worked. In 4 years, Roper's EBITDA and free cash flow increased by more than double, and the stock had beaten the market return by a multiple of 4. This, to be clear, was not well understood at the time. Scott Davis was a relatively new industrial analyst during the early years of Jellison's reign and saw firsthand why his playbook was so difficult to understand.
"Jellison was good at describing the high-margin, high-cash characteristics of his assets, but he failed to communicate any tangible or repeatable growth algorithm to investors. He explained the CRI concept and his view that as Roper's returns rose, so would its PE multiple. The problem, however, was that since each of his acquisitions came with a low asset base, almost by definition, the amount of goodwill created in each deal would be high. Therefore, his returns on a more traditional accounting construct like ROIC would actually go down each time a deal was closed. Then it would begin to rise after the deal, only to be deflated by another deal. For traditional investors, that was a challenge to understand. To buy into Jellison's vision, you had to turn traditional accounting frameworks upside down and focus on the returns of the transaction after it closed, the returns earned on each additional dollar of investment. You needed a long-term view because in the short term, the deal would rarely look all that attractive. This was exactly the reason for the mispricing in the first place. Deals just looked expensive, both to M&A bankers and to the CEOs and boards they advised. Jellison's successes were often explained by critics as luck and pure financial engineering. In hindsight, too many good things happened at Roper over too many years for it to be mere accident. He bought good assets, seemed to run them better than they had ever been run, and developed a consistent growth pattern driven not just by M&A and R&D investments, but also by high operating leverage within the assets themselves.
Roper made its first pure software acquisition in 2008. The company acquired CBoard that provided card access systems and food service software to colleges, businesses and senior living campuses for $375 million. CBoard had customer retention rates in excess of 95%, low working capital requirements and a high EBITDA. Shaposhnik commented, CBoard was one of the highest CRI businesses Roper had acquired and likely opened management's eyes to the attractiveness of software businesses. If Dial-A-Truck gave Roper a taste of the benefits of software, CBoard had the company hooked. Roper acquired United Toll Systems, which automated toll collection systems, and iTrade, a software provider that facilitated the trade of perishable goods in quick succession. Only one of Roper's major acquisitions, Dynisco, a supplier of testing instruments to the plastics industry, was reminiscent of the company's industrial roots. David Kim, investor and author of reputed value investing blog Scuttleblurb, writes,
"At this point, Roper was still best described as a product company, but they had taken some gateway drugs, TransCore, iTrade, CBoard, a few others, that primed them for the harder stuff, acquisitions with higher software purity. The evolution was only natural. Roper was specifically going after capital-light targets with high margins, recurring revenue, and modest macro sensitivity, with the directive that each new acquisition should be better on those dimensions than the portfolio average. If the bar is ratcheted higher every year, then whether you originally meant to or not, you will eventually end up buying software companies." And that's pretty much what Roper did for the next 13 years up to the present day.
Between Roper's acquisition of CBoard in 2008 and 2022, Roper invested a total of $20 billion in the acquisition of 15 software businesses, including property management software, human capital and business ops management, and billing infrastructure. According to Shaposhnik, the common thread is a focus on acquiring the leading provider in that particular niche area of a software market. But this raises another question. Why was Roper uncontested in its pursuit of software companies? One would think that an industrial conglomerate would struggle to acquire software outfits, especially if there are other savvier players with no burden of history. Davies explains that Jellison could afford to go after mid-growth companies, which worked well for a surprisingly long time.
Traditional software companies like Oracle or Microsoft generally favoured internal new product investment. When they did do acquisitions, they wanted a high growth profile, certainly above 10%, and rarely near the 5% ballpark that Roper was more than happy to take. Jellison found the biggest mispricings in less sexy, slower, but still solid growers. These were usually software companies in highly niche markets. Software was in a different world from that of Roper's traditional businesses, and critics viewed the company as going down a path it didn't understand. But Jellison saw it more simply, starting with the basic fundamentals of the software sales cycle. Contracts were typically paid up front, with the cash often received before the revenue was even booked, such as in a subscription model. Deferred revenue meant that Jellison could run his company on zero or negative working capital. That entire concept made him almost giddy. There were no factories to invest in, and there was very limited cyclicality to worry about. A large installed base made it harder to get disrupted, at least quickly. And most of these companies weren't all that well run, meaning Roper could help them to improve operations. in the sales and marketing organization, for example. Jellison could take that 5% unit growth, and through operational improvement, he could translate it into nearly 10% profit growth. He then could utilize cash to purchase similar assets that would add another 5 to 10% to the top line, translating over time to 15 to 20% annualized profit growth. He did this without using equity and maintaining investment-grade debt. Few companies can sustain high teens profit growth over time. Jellison was in that ballpark most of his 17 years as CEO.
Currently, Roper's business is divided into two main segments. Vertical market software, which accounts for 75% of total sales, and medical and water technology, comprising the remaining 25%. This bifurcation is attributable to major divestments affected by Roper in June 2022. In the process, Roper had divested businesses that represented 40% of the company's revenue base, all of which was replaced by software revenue. Acquisitions have played a disproportionately big role in shaping the business of Roper. To this point, the former CFO of one of Roper's portfolio companies said in a June 2023 Tegas interview,
"Roper themselves, they don't make a product. They don't provide a service. They acquire companies that meet certain financial metrics, and it's not even that they focus on an industry, but there's a kind of a company type to some degree that they go after, and if they kind of meet certain criteria, they acquire those companies."
Roper employs a distinctive strategy while choosing companies to acquire. First and foremost, the company is an extraordinarily selective acquirer. Roper is almost singularly focused on whether the prospective business generates high cash returns. Some of the key financial metrics they examine are CRI, organic growth numbers, and EBITDA margins. Speaking more broadly, Roper favors targets that dominate a niche with growth potential and limited market competition. The ideal Roper company also has a strong leadership team in place, one that is competent to run the show independently, even post-acquisition. Once Roper identifies an attractive target, they move fast. Shaposhnik continues, "There aren't that many companies that can write a $5 billion or $10 billion check and execute diligence as quickly as Roper can." Roper is now reaping the benefits of its long history of acquisitions. For example, Roper favors acquiring businesses from private equity firms, particularly those held for around 3 years. This timing is strategic. It's after the PE firm has streamlined operations, but before they pursue conventional exit strategies like an initial public offering. Roper has built robust connections with PE firms, looking to divest companies that align with this criteria. Over the years, Roper has developed the reputation of being a good buyer who is invested in the growth of their targets long term. The company typically makes it a point to develop relationships with management teams before the transaction. One transaction stands out as a rare misstep in Roper's career as an acquirer: the acquisition of Sunquest, a developer of diagnostic and lab software, in 2012. Sunquest was a promising target because its software was used by a third of the hospitals in America. It had 60% margins and was growing at around 10%. However, it began losing market share to electronic health record vendors who bundled lab information software into their broader platforms. Roper tackled this by folding Sunquest into Clinisys, an information software development company they acquired in 2015. According to pseudonymous investor and newsletter writer Liberty RPF, this taught Roper a lesson: to avoid niche software markets where a vertical solution predates the broader enterprise layer, as the latter may eventually come to integrate the former. After making an acquisition, Roper allows the new business to run independently with limited interference. This approach is justified by the lack of back-end resources and systems shared across the company. It also aligns with their acquisition philosophy to buy mature, high-performing companies. In practice, this translates into two levels of oversight from Roper: regular contact, in the form of weekly phone calls and quarterly on-site visits with a Roper executive who is assigned 6 to 12 portfolio companies to oversee, and an evaluation by the company headquarters once or twice a year. The latter form of intervention is variable based on the performance and materiality of the portfolio company. One key area where Roper does intervene is an active audit group that conducts financial and operational audits of business units from time to time. Roper also assigns coaches to these units that guide executives on matters of strategy and execution. However, the final call on any manner usually lies with the target's management. Roper motivates management teams by tying their incentives to overall performance. The compensation structure is divided into three parts: a reasonable base, an annual bonus that is only paid out if EBITDA, or operating profit results, increase by more than 5%. As compared to the previous year, the bonus amount itself is variable based on the results. And depending on the seniority of the person and in importance of the business, equity-based incentives like stock options. This culture of autonomy and decentralization is fundamental to Roper. To maintain a healthy degree of uniformity, the company assigns executives to work with the presidents of business units on matters of cybersecurity, talent management, and recruitment. Roper also has quarterly reviews, which focus on EBITDA leverage, cash flow, and return on investment. While more strategic evaluations take place every 3 years to review plans for growth. As for other HR practices, Jellison emphasized hiring young talent and giving them real responsibilities, a culture that lives on today. Shaposhnik said on this:
"And I think that the fact that the stock continued to perform well after he departed is one indicator that he and the board did a great job in selecting the next team, led by Neil Hunn, the current CEO, in supporting Neil with a great team around him, which of course he's built over the last several years."
While Roper is run in a decentralized manner, the allocation of capital is centralized. Most of the company's capital is deployed toward acquisitions. The company believes that it has an advantage of low-cost capital because its primary source of funding is excess cash generated by business units and cheap debt. Other than acquisitions, Roper spent roughly 2% of its capital on CapEx and 12% on R&D, as assessed between 2002 and 2022. Brian Jellison believed there are three key dials that determine the productivity of a public company, and Roper excels in each. Cash flow acceleration. Is the company accelerating cash flow by tapping into additional sources of capital? In the case of Roper, for every $1 billion of cash flow generated, the company invests $1.4 billion in acquisitions, making for 140% acceleration. Allocation of cash. What is the company doing with the cash generated? Roper invested 90% of the cash flow generated in acquiring new businesses. Quality of ideas invested in. Is the existing enterprise's CRI improving because of these acquisitions? Roper improved its CRI by a multiple of more than 4 over a decade. Jellison stepped down from Roper in September 2018, citing health reasons. He was 72. He passed away in November that same year. Bloomberg published an obituary under the headline "The Industrial World Lost One of Its Best Leaders" and wrote in a subheading, "Roper Industries' Brian Jellison isn't well known outside of certain circles. He should be." Jeffrey Bronchick from Cove Street Capital opened his obit with a pithier quip. "At lunch, a long time ago, Brian told me, here is our plan. Buy businesses with 40% gross margins from idiots in private equity who don't know how to run them. It was a good plan. And it worked." This case is part of the Common Cog case library and is an instantiation of the following concepts: capital cycle, capital expertise, capital allocation, and incentive design. Remember to compare this case to other cases you know.